congratulations on the release of Panic Desire. I've been staying off public transport for the moment, walking to and from work, which is kind of located at the start of the CBD here in Sydney. And this record has really become a fitting soundtrack for that commute. And you've mentioned that this album is a sort of soundtrack to your PhD thesis. For those that don't know, you're an architecture academic and designer, and I'm wondering if you could expand on that and how this album has intersected with your academic work and those other disciplines.
When I started my PhD, it occurred to me that music was a really great way of communicating emotions and ideas about architecture. And it's not something that I think is uncommon. I think that, you know, over time there's been a lot of intersections between music and architecture, and usually it's been through the format of cinema, or it's been, you know, architects that have sort of left school and joined bands and stuff, and there's a few of them floating around. I was keen on merging the disciplines quite consciously, and I guess my experience of being gender nonconforming and my experience of moving through cities, whether it be Melbourne or whether it be Sydney or any city internationally, I wanted to communicate what that experience was like in a theoretical sense, in a musical sense. But performance has also been a really big part of what I do, and that event and how that is an experience in itself. I guess I've been able to explore that practice a lot more widely. Each song is like a day in the week, if you like.
It's done so beautifully and honestly, I think. There's those obvious references to cities and spaces and architecture in some of the titles of the tracks, like Gender Nonconforming City, Monolith, Panopticon. The track that really did stand out for me personally was that closing track, Panopticon, and I wanted to ask you a bit about that.
I performed that for Midsummer at Art House. And at the time, I was really trying to understand, I guess, the disconnection between the sort of tactile and the virtual spaces that I occupy, and how important that experience is in gender and sexuality as well, and the communities that we feel part of or that we might feel excluded from as well, but also that how those spaces are a place of visibility, of invisibility, of understanding, of misunderstanding, but they're a place of surveillance as well. And I was just interested in critiquing my own, you know, buy-in to that, to the social media context, and how I'd created my world, my own world within that. So Panopticon, I guess, is an extension of just the online world that we create for ourselves, and how this sort of edited representation of realities that we put in there, and how we are in fact kind of looking at each other through that, and what sort of pressure, you know, and it also links back to the half-light as well, which is how connected do we really feel in these places? How connected do we feel in the mall? How connected do we feel in, you know, through our Instagram stories, or, you know, through these huge lists of followers and friends and stuff. And
this was a much more collaborative record than your previous work. It was recorded by Evelyn Ida Morris, FKA Pikelet, and there's production from Jane Cecil of Architecture in Helsinki, vocals from Matriarchy, Raquel Solier on acoustic drums, M. Gafer on guitar. And you also put together a live band that had a few performances, I believe, including one definitely at Golden Plains right before COVID and all this went down. What led to you welcoming more folks to work on this record?
Well, I just wanted a bigger sound. I mean, the first thing that you'll notice on this record, which is different to other records, is that the drums sound so much bigger. And, you know, I wanted to explore so much more space. So I needed to build a relationship with the acoustic drum kit and I can't play them both at the same time. So I was really lucky to work with Raquel Soler, who's also various artists. And we played a whole lot of shows, which, you know, last year, and that sort of turned into some recording sessions. And it just enabled me to explore that relationship, create that space, create that depth. And so, you know, in order to do that, I had to get out of the bedroom. It was the first time I'd gone into a studio. So, you know, working with Evelyn, you know, was a great experience in just opening up my mind to how we sonically put that together. So there's just so many different sounds that I wanted to get out of this record. I did want the cinematic, and I did want the pop, and, you know, and I did want the sort of dance and the new wave things. And the result is, yeah, I did create a world. I'm glad to hear that you say it's this sort of thing that you use on the, that you can listen to on the commute, because, you know, I've written it for walking. I've written it for traveling. You know, I've written it for the car, for the train, for the tram, for the airport, for all of these spaces. And it's, you know, one thing, I guess, it's really difficult when you're gender nonconforming and you're moving through the city is, I guess, trying to find that safe place that you can pass through these spaces. And, you know, having the headphones in kind of blocks out a lot of noise that I'd rather not hear, for instance. You know, there's a lot of street hassle and a bit of abuse that I get. And, you know, having the headphones in and having some good music in is a way to move through that.
Definitely. I mean, for me, I'm cisgender, but I'm a woman of colour, and it made me think about my experiences as a woman of colour navigating the city, but also living in other cities like New York, which is so prominent in catcalling.
Oh, outright. I mean, you know, some of my worst experiences of trans misogyny have been in New York City, you know, and every city has its own way of being hostile. And Panic Desire is really about navigating these hostile spaces in order to find spaces of some kind of comfortability or spaces of connection. We have to navigate risk in order to find places of some kind of comfort. And I think that's an experience which people, you know, have at different intersections. So, yeah, I'm glad that you can find something in that for you too.
Another major theme of Panic/Desire is the imagining of future cities, and particularly different ways of living with other people. And I was wondering if science fiction and utopian fiction perhaps played a part here.
Oh, huge part. Huge part. And again, I guess it's those experiences of architecture and music that I've always drawn on. I mean, if I think of, you know, Jeff Mills' soundtrack to Metropolis and Vangelis' soundtrack to Blade Runner, you know, I think of bands like Air, for instance, who have, even Pink Floyd and stuff. So every time when I've conceived a project as a student, particularly, you know, I'd be listening to music that would be completely in the zone of what I was trying to achieve. And you know, when I was working, you know, a student, music was informing form for me. So I'd just be sort of reinterpreting my understanding of sound, I guess my graphic understanding of sound, and trying to figure out how that could generate plan or section or some kind of building form, which was what I did for my master's.
Yeah, I mean, on that, I guess the other side of things are some of the more real-world practices and ways of approach that you have looked into in your PhD. I was wondering if you could maybe touch on some of those.
So the PhD is embedded in, I guess, lived experience, rather than it being in, I guess, research methods of, you know, we surveyed 100 people and they all thought this. I mean,
yeah.
You know, the evidence is there. The thing that I certainly in my early reading is the evidence is there that trans and gender nonconforming people find particularly cities a hostile place, a violent space, a place of discrimination, and citizenship is daily contested. And so I'm trying to imagine a city where those outcomes aren't there.
Mm.
And what are some of the things that we need to do in order to, I guess, break those things down? And I think it does come down to architecture being rebuilt, reimagined as a social justice practice and not as a neoliberal practice. You know, and that's a, you know, that's a huge task. I mean, but, you know, someone's got to sort of put that idea forward. I think that in order to break down gender binaries as they're administered within architectural space, you know, it's much the same process as we might be trying to do in the legal process or the medical process, that architecture is really just another discipline or profession that affects, you know, cities, our societies and citizenship so much that if we can take out sort of heteronormative, cisnormative ideas of, you know, binary gender, you know, what are those outcomes? What does that city look like? What is that experience going to be? And what are those spaces going to be like? And what I'm finding is that that investigation speaks to so many different experiences of surveillance or oppression. And I'm just sort of looking for the ways that we can unite.
One part while I was going through your website that kind of drew me in into all of this is how can architecture hold space for emotion, place to cry, which made me think of this book that I'm currently reading by Jenny O'Dell that talks a bit about public space, in particular this rose garden in Oakland, which she becomes a bit of a refuge to her. And I think the way we measure productivity and how that almost conflates to the value of a space.
I feel like, you know, if we were kind of to look at places of memorial, often places of memorial in urban space are connected to ideas of nationalism.
And this is a topic that is particularly relevant for the moment.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, if we see, of monuments and even if we kind of look at, I mean, let's take, for instance, like, you know, the 9/11 memorial. You know, with the sort of footprints of the World Trade Center or something like that. And, you know, like this is the idea of empathy-informed urban space. And I'm just like, wow, what about just making it really easy for people to get on and off public transport without feeling as if they're being trapped? There's some really basic principles. I mean, you don't have to have these like huge, big sort of disasters to happen in order to implement empathy into the way that we design or think about cities. I mean, there are everyday things that happen to people that are just not considered.
Yeah, I mean,
that can affect the way that we can move through our cities.
One end of the spectrum is potentially memorializing trauma, but let's maybe address trauma that's already happening, that's currently happening.
Yeah, that's right, you know, and it's just because it's sort of, it's not part of the everyday cis, het, white experience. When that experience happens, it's sort of, it's deemed to happen on such a huge scale that we need to sort of, you know, do things like, you know, these big memorial pools or these, you know, these, you know, huge sites.
Huge gestures, yeah.
Yeah, these big gestures with so much ceremony attached to them. And it's just kind of like, can't you do that on a really basic day-to-day level?
Micro like, level.
Yeah, you know. And I guess so the empathy is about connecting with that experience. But sadly, empathy is being co-opted by neoliberal ideas of practice. You know, and that's sadly not unusual that commerce adapts, you know, I guess these sort of social justice ways in order to seem edgy in the way that sustainability was, I guess, in the 2000s and feel as if some aspects of social justice is being co-opted. And that's disappointing because as a trans person, something that might just save me at the end of the day, but if it's just being sort of, you know, co-opted, then, you know, who for and for what purpose? And